and political commentator Said Mohsen Abbas out of London, and journalist and political analyst Mostafa Khoshesh out of Tehran. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashmi. Goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. Now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatemi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Qul inna salati ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful, say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things, and no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land, and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Russia describes as complex the initial security talks with the U.S. after it ruled out any concessions to Washington. Iran warns the U.S. is seeking to create rifts between Afghanistan and its neighboring countries. At least 19 people are killed and dozens injured in a huge blaze ripping through a New York apartment building. Welcome to the program. Russia says that initial talks with the U.S. on the eve of a forthcoming crucial meeting between Moscow and Washington has been, quote, complex but businesslike. Russian media say Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Ryabkov has described a meeting with his U.S. counterpart Wendy Sherman as amazing. However, it is not clear if the veteran diplomat was speaking ironically. Russian and American diplomats are due to meet for talks in the Swiss city of Geneva on Monday. The meeting comes amid tensions between Washington and Moscow over Ukraine. Earlier we spoke to political commentator Marcus Papadopoulos about the upcoming talks between Russia and the U.S. He says he welcomes the negotiations but believes Washington's promises would mean nothing in the long term.
The forthcoming meeting between the Americans and the Russians concerning the Ukraine crisis. And I also welcome the reports we have been receiving in the last few days that the Americans may offer the Russians possibility of Washington scaling down NATO's presence in Eastern Europe, which indicates that Russia has, as many of us have said for many years now, a legitimate grievance over NATO's presence in Eastern Europe, which is a gross violation of the NATO-Russia founding treaty of 1997. An American pledge in writing would be welcomed, but in the long term, it would not mean anything. After all, America has violated the NATO-Russia founding treaty of 1997 by positioning NATO forces in Eastern Europe. Secondly, when NATO bombed the Federal Republic of Yugoslavia in 1999, the Americans, who are the de facto leader of NATO, violated Article 1 of NATO's founding treaty, which clearly stipulates that NATO will never use force to resolve a dispute. Mm-hmm. So an American pledge in writing is not worth the paper it's written on.
Kazakhstan's health ministry says 164 people have been killed in unrest that hit the country last week following protests over a fuel price hike. The ministry says the majority of the victims lost their lives in the main city, Almaty. It says some of saw that as some of the fiercest clashes between protesters and security forces. The Kazakh presidency says almost 6,000 people, including foreign nationals, have been arrested in connection with the unrest. The government says things have now stabilized, but counter-terror operations will continue. Kazakhstan says Russian-led peacekeepers are now protecting several of its strategic facilities. Some small cities are still witnessing protests. They've continued even after the government resigned and the president restored fuel price caps.
Kazakhstan faces its worst violence experienced since the independence of the Central Asian country in the early 1990s. As the Soviet Union collapsed, dozens of people have died while public buildings across the country have been looted and torched over the past week. It all began with fuel reforms that took effect on January 1, 2022, leading to the doubling of liquefied petroleum gas prices.
Simple events, increasing prices for liquid gas, which most people in Kazakhstan using as a fuel for cars and as a fuel for heating the houses, that was a trigger, that kind of event.
Following that, demonstrations began in the western Manjistau province on Sunday, but then spread across the country and turned violent, resulting in clashes between protesters and security forces. Kazakh President Kasym-Jomart Tokayev's response included accepting the resignation of the government and announcing fixed fuel prices, but also ordering a crackdown. The unrest prompted Tokayev to appeal for help from the Collective Security Treaty Organization to restore peace and security. The Collective Security Treaty Organization is a Russian-led alliance of former Soviet states including Russia, Belarus, Tajikistan, Armenia, Kyrgyzstan, and Kazakhstan. Tokayev blames foreign-trained terrorists for the unrest. He describes a large proportion of the protesters as criminals, saying 20,000 bandits were involved in the unrest in Almaty, Kazakhstan's largest city and the center of the recent unrest. Consequently, he has authorized security forces to open fire without warning in case of further unrest. Initial peaceful protests appear to have been subverted by seemingly well-organized groups of rioters, particularly on Wednesday when the police seemed to leave key installations in the city unprotected. The unrest is seen as an attempt by foreign parties to provoke color revolutions in the ex-Soviet country, modeled on the Rose Revolution in Georgia and the Orange Revolution in Ukraine, which Russia has blamed on the West as an attempt to undermine the security of Kazakhstan.
Obviously, some game of the superpower and Western interference and covert operations always exist.
Russia's top envoy in the U.S., Anatoly Antonov, blames Washington's foreign policy for helping to provoke the crisis in Kazakhstan. Antonov says the root cause of the mayhem is the destabilization in the Middle East and Afghanistan, caused in turn by 2 decades of U.S. military intervention across Western and Central Asia, under the pretext of defending human rights and democracy.
The unrest in Kazakhstan has left more than 100 people dead. Public buildings were torched and ransacked in several cities, including the main one, Almaty. The government has called for assistance from a regional security alliance led by Russia to quell the unrest. Meanwhile, Moscow has criticized Washington after it said Kazakhstan would be saddled with a Russian presence. Take a look.
Russia says the reason behind its decision to provide military support for Kazakhstan is reaffirming its commitment to allied obligations within the Collective Security Treaty Organization. In addition, Moscow views the recent developments in Kazakhstan as externally provoked attempts at disrupting the security and integrity of the state through violent means, including trained and organized armed groups. Russia also slammed U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken as boorish for saying Kazakhstan would be settled with Russian presence after asking Moscow to send in troops. This came after Blinken told reporters on Friday
that I think one lesson of recent history is that once Russians are in your house, it's sometimes very difficult to get them to leave.
Moscow ramped up the criticism further, also going on to cite a number of Washington's invasions, interventions, and military occupations over the decades, suggesting Blinken might learn a history lesson of his own. It mentioned unfortunate people who had the bad luck to see these uninvited guests at their doorstep, naming Native Americans, Koreans, Vietnamese, and Syrians, among others.
But Russia has much better track record than United States, because United States has about 800 military objects and bases around the globe, and staying unwelcome in a lot of countries.
Russian President Vladimir Putin and his Kazakh counterpart, Kasym-Jomart Tokayev, held a phone conversation to discuss the ongoing unrest in Kazakhstan on Saturday. The two discussed steps to restore order in the country. Tokayev also informed Putin in detail about the situation in the country, noting that it is developing towards a stabilization.
Iran's foreign minister criticizes the U.S. and its allies for what he calls the wrong policies in Afghanistan over the past 20 years. Hossein Amir Abdullahian was speaking with Afghanistan's acting foreign minister Amir Khan Muttaqi in Tehran. Amir Abdullahian said history has shown that no foreign power can occupy and rule Afghanistan. The Iranian top diplomat warned that the U.S. is seeking to create rifts between Afghanistan and its neighboring countries. He has also called for the release of the Afghan central bank assets that remain frozen by the U.S. The Afghan official said Iran has always stood by his country. Amir Khan Muttaqi said the U.S. left Afghanistan with a disgraceful defeat and still continues its policies against people there. We spoke to activist and commentator Farazan Najim about U.S. policies in Afghanistan. He believes Washington supports crises and poverty in the country, as it does for other nations in West Asia.
I mean, it's very clear that the U.S. used Afghanistan as a landscape to practice all their weapons and train there and, you know, destroy the nation and keep it in the worst conditions. This was the motive from the American side, is that they, you know, fabricated a justification to invade that country. And this was an area for them to just try all their new weapons and, you know, train their army to get stronger. And it was the door to open in the Middle East to expand their invasions and to try to install fear in other countries. The U.S. obviously is not going to release these funds, because, like you said, that they want the poverty, they want the problems, they want people to be suffering and hungry, so there can be more disunity and there can be more instability in Afghanistan. And then they will hope that this will somehow create chaos and spill over to Iran. Unfortunately, they don't care about human rights. They don't care about humanity. If they really did, they wouldn't be causing all these crises in Afghanistan, in Yemen, supporting the Saudi coalition, supporting the Israeli occupation of Palestine, blockading right now and causing a big embargo on Lebanon. You know, they've occupied Iraq for such a long time, and they left Iraq in the worst conditions. They won't even let the Iraqi government purchase fighter jets to safeguard their country.
Harsh winter has worsened the already dire conditions of millions of Afghans struggling with hunger and poverty, especially those who have become homeless or displaced due to droughts or conflicts over the past months. Rahmatullah Balban reports from Kabul.
Snowfall and dropping temperatures have increased the problems of the poor and needy people across Afghanistan. Here, we are visiting some displaced families who face harsh conditions in their camps in Kabul. Bushra Amiri, a mother of 10, is displaced from Helmand province. She says she has nothing to feed her children or heat her simple shack.
I am a widow and have several children. I'm really desperate to feed them and keep them warm. My neighbors used to help us, but now everyone is short of money and food.
Other people in this camp have the same problems. Almost all of them are deprived of their basic needs.
There is no hope for survival. We are left here with no house, no money, and no bread. We are human beings. Why is no one paying attention to us or help us? What should we do in this cold weather and severe snowfall?
These displaced families hope that the charities and the government could help them to survive the winter. Hundreds of men and women from two camps have come here to enlist them for receiving some aids.
Here you see internally displaced people from different provinces of Afghanistan. They are in urgent need of food and medicines. In addition, Their tents are being collapsed due to rainfalls. We are enlisting for humanitarian aid, but it won't be sufficient for survival.
Bishra Amiri is happy as she receives some aid and food donated by the WFP and the Gulzad Group.
I'm very happy today because I have received some food for my family. My children will have something to eat for next month. We thank charities for their humanitarian aid. However, we need more assistance, including warming clothes and heating.
Afghanistan's financial system has been in a free fall since the Taliban took over, partly due to aid cuts and the freeze of some $10 billion in Afghan assets by the U.S.
In addition to dealing with cold weather, most of these families are unable to buy food and medicines. They say it will be very difficult for them to survive this harsh winter if urgent assistance is not provided. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Yemen says the Saudi-led coalition's pretexts for targeting the country's ports are mere theatrical posturing and aimed at legitimizing the aggression. Yemeni Foreign Ministry says the remarks made by the coalition's spokesperson, Turki al-Maliki, about materializing or militarizing Hodeida and Salif ports, I would imagine, are baseless and false. On Saturday, the coalition said targeting the two ports is justified as Yemenis are using them as military bases. It also released footage purportedly showing weapons stored at the ports. The Yemeni army says the video is taken from an American documentary film about Iraq and has nothing to do with Yemen. The years-long Saudi-led war and blockade have put the lives of millions of Yemenis at risk and created what the UN has described as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Earlier, we reached out to political commentator Hussein al-Bukhaiti. He says the fake footage shown at the Saudi-led coalition's presser raises questions about its grounds for conducting thousands of airstrikes on Yemen.
This exactly shows what we here in Yemen, what Yemeni civilians are dealing with. They are dealing with the war that actually led by Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is actually trying to fabricate news to attack Hodeida port. I mean, it's really impossible as an example for Yemeni forces to use Hodeida port because there are a United Nations team located in Hodeida, and as well all the ships are searched by the Saudi-backed forces and the Saudi coalition. But what Al-Asiri actually, Al-Maliki, he did actually the biggest mistake. It shows that the war actually on Yemen based on lie. And just you can just imagine if Al-Maliki and the coalition is using those footage who were taken from a movie as a proof to target Hodeida port, you can imagine they have launched and striked Yemen. More than 150,000 airstrike has been conducted on Yemen, according to some news outside news agency. And you can just imagine what kind of proof they had at that time to attack those areas. They have killed more than 18,000 Yemeni civilians, most of them children, because of those airstrikes. They have that blockade on Yemen, which have resulted in killing more than 300,000 Yemeni civilians.
And finally, a huge blaze in the U.S. state of New York leaves at least 19 people dead and dozens injured. The fire tears through a high-rise apartment building in the Bronx, that's a borough of New York City. Officials say several of the wounded are in critical condition. An overwhelming majority of the victims suffer from severe smoke inhalation. Firefighters discovered the victims on nearly every floor of the building. Many of them were experiencing cardiac and respiratory arrest. Firefighters rescued many residents by evacuating them through windows and climbing down ladders. The fire is reportedly caused by a portable electric heater.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrents fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for Thee. I ask Thee concerning the complaints of Thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among Thy servants, of a handmaid from among Thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask Thee, O He who owns all objects of need which are granted by His will and hastened to His desire, that Thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that Thou willst, and givest me mercy from Thee. Forgiveness decreases Thee not, and giving injuries Thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from Thee: the facility to obey Thee at its beginning, and the favor of Thy forgiveness at its end. O He who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sin.
the limelight.
A petition of nearly 300 people have been flooded, and their advocates argue that the U.S. federal government's current flood insurance policies are inadequate for an era of climate crisis. We now present you an article concerning this issue written by Oliver Millman. The piece is titled, Everything is at Risk. Flood survivors urge U.S. Congress to change inadequate insurance. Towns and cities across the United States increasingly deluged by ferocious storms and rising sea levels. A group of disaster survivors has pleaded with the federal government to overhaul a flood insurance system they say is ill-equipped for an era of climate crisis. A petition of nearly 300 people who have been flooded and their advocates is set to be sent to the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, to call for a drastic overhaul of the government-run flood insurance system that underwrites most flood policies in the United States. The petition, organized by Anthropocene Alliance, an environmental nonprofit, reads, "We've lived without electricity, running water, and secure shelter. We've heard our children cry from the absence of friends, school, and safety. And we've confronted homelessness, illness, and mind-numbing red tape from insurance companies and government agencies. The survivors are calling for a ban on irresponsible housing development in flood-prone areas, new rules that would provide buyers with the present and future flood risks of a property before purchasing it, and a greater focus on relocating communities and elevating properties away from floodwater, rather than simply funding rebuilding flooded homes in the same place as before." Stephen Eisenman, Director of Strategy at Anthropocene Alliance, said, "To continue to build in vulnerable places does not make sense and needs to come to a halt. A lot of people are suckered into buying in these places because there's no federal disclosure laws. This is turning into a crisis, especially for poorer people." Stephen Eisenman added, "We are beginning to see the start of a great American flood migration, and that exodus is only going to accelerate in the next decade. To keep building in these areas is just crazy." Particular controversy is a process called fill and build, where developers heap soil upon flood-prone areas, elevating them slightly before building housing upon the compacted dirt. Critics say this simply diverts floodwater to neighbors and is a short-term fix to a chronic problem. Amber Bismack, a petition signatory who lives in Livingston County, Michigan, which is part of Detroit's metropolitan area, said, "We have developers building on wetland areas that can't hold water anymore, so it just flows off onto us." Amber Bismack moved to the area close to a tributary of the Huron River 7 years ago and has seen her neighborhood flooded on 15 occasions. "The flooding has become so bad at times that Bismack has had to don waders to carry her children home through floodwater. The family have had to temporarily move out of the house, too, when the drains stopped working because of the flooding." She said that the worsening floods are taking its toll on the local community. Amber Bismack, who is part of a community group that is calling for Congress to mandate flood risk disclosure to all potential home buyers, says, "I can't tell you how much depression we're seeing in the community because it just floods over and over again. We've seen a real decline in people's mental health." She added, "I know someone who thought their flood insurance would be $1,000 a year, but couldn't find out the true risk until they bought, and it was deemed by FEMA to be high risk with a premium of $13,000 a year, which is unlivable. People are just stuck. The National Flood Insurance Scheme was launched in 1968 and has become the default for millions of Americans unable to get mortgages without flood insurance, which is routinely denied by private providers. However, the system has been driven into debt, with some homes repeatedly rebuilt in the same place only to be flooded again. The Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, deems homes at risk if they're in something called the 100-year floodplain, which means they have a 1% risk each year of getting a foot of water in flooding. However, this system does not account for the proximity to water or the unfolding climate crisis, meaning that many of the flood maps are inaccurate and premiums do not reflect the actual risk of flooding. Jackie Jones, a resident of Raysville, Georgia, a town that often floods following heavy rainfall, said, "The Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, is a joke. It doesn't update its flood maps. I wouldn't have bought this house if I knew I'd get so much water. But based on FEMA's maps, there's no flooding here. They need to step up and take some control." In October, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, unveiled a new system called Risk Rating 2.0 that aims to address a situation where nearly half of the flood claims received by FEMA are from people outside zones where insurance is required. Around three-quarters of the 4.9 million federal insurance policyholders will pay more for their premiums. David Morstad, a senior executive of the National Flood Insurance Program, told Associated Press, "We've learned that the old way of looking at risk has lots of gaps which understated a property's flood risk and communicated a false sense of security. The elevated premiums have been opposed by some members of Congress who argue it will hurt people who require affordable housing. But Eisenman says the reforms do not go far enough, as they do not actually curb new building on risky floodplains." Eisenman said, "Much more profound changes are needed. Instances of nuisance flooding, where high tides exacerbated by sea level rise cause streets and homes to fill with water, have increased dramatically along U.S. coastlines in recent years, and more powerful storms fueled by a heating atmosphere are bringing heavier bursts of rainfall to parts of the country. Research has found rising sea levels alone could force around 13 million Americans to relocate by the end of the century. However, for many people, moving is not an option due to financial constraints or ties to home." Rebecca Jim, who lives in the Cherokee Nation in Oklahoma, says, "There is a great concern and fear because everything is at risk, even people's lives." Miami, a city in the area, has been regularly flooded by water that washes toxins from a nearby mining site onto homes, schools, and businesses. Rebecca Jim says, "It's foolish and criminal that more building is allowed on floodplains, but much of what is flooded here is tribal land, and people here aren't moving from that."
This is IRIB English Radio. website is www.parstoday.com/en.
Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent, a weekly show that aims to address the most significant issues in the South Asian region that affect the governments, organizations, communities, and especially the people. And as always, we will explore and explain its geopolitics, untangle the arguments from different perspectives, and make the alternative voices heard. So, stay tuned.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will look at the recent civilian killings in the northeastern Indian state of Nagaland and why calls are growing louder for the repeal of a controversial law. And we shall discuss the breach of religious freedom in Indian-controlled Kashmir, vis-à-vis the closure of the region's central mosque and a ban on Muharram processions.
The recent civilian killings in India's Nagaland state have reignited the long-running debate over a controversial law that confers armed forces with unbridled powers, prompting the Provincial Legislative Assembly to unanimously pass a resolution calling for its abrogation. The trigger was the killing of 6 coal mine workers early this month in a botched counter-insurgency operation. In the ensuing clashes, 7 more civilians were killed. The incidents sparked widespread protests in Nagaland and fueled calls for the repeal of the law.
On the fateful evening of December the 4th, Indian Army soldiers opened fire at a pickup truck carrying coal miners in Nagaland's Mon district. 6 civilians were killed on the spot. Later that day, 7 more civilians and a soldier died in clashes between people and police. On December the 5th, one more civilian was shot dead when angry protesters ambushed an army camp. Army soldiers had apparently mistaken the group of coal miners for insurgents. India's Home Minister Amit Shah said the government regretted what he called the unfortunate incident, describing civilian killings as the case of mistaken identity. In the days after Shah's statement, angry protesters filled the streets across Nagaland and adjoining states, demanding the minister's apology and, more importantly, calling for the repeal of Armed Forces Special Powers Act, a draconian law that provides grounds for men in uniform in India's so-called disturbed areas to commit horrendous human rights abuses. On December the 20th, the Nagaland State Assembly unanimously passed a resolution demanding that the BJP government at centre repeal the controversial and much-abused law from the state and from the rest of the Northeast. It also demanded that the appropriate authority issue an apology for the massacre and that justice be delivered to the perpetrators.
It's not the first instance that the Armed Forces Special Powers Act has hogged headlines for the wrong reasons. The controversial law, enacted in 1958 to maintain control and curb insurgency in what the Indian government considered disturbed areas, is in force in at least 5 Indian states. The legislation has drawn flak from national and international human rights watchdogs as it gives unbridled powers and immunity to the armed personnel to shoot, kill, make arrests on flimsy pretexts, conduct searches without warrant, and demolish structures.
The controversial law, also known as AFSPA, was first enacted in 1958 to allow deployment of armed forces to counter a secessionist movement in the hills of Nagaland. 6 decades later, it is in force in Manipur, Assam, parts of Arunachal Pradesh, and in the Union Territory of Jammu and Kashmir, the places labeled as disturbed areas. The legislation gives license to Indian Army soldiers to carry out excesses without fear of legal prosecution, even when they kill and injure people, raid houses without warrant, or use deadly and indiscriminate force on mere suspicion, like the case of Nagaland killings. The law has long shielded Indian soldiers stationed in the so-called disturbed areas from accountability for grave human rights abuses and has denied justice to the affected families. A 2019 report on Jammu and Kashmir by the Office of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights said the law remains a key obstacle to accountability. Following the latest incident in Nagaland, which has shaken the conscience of the nation of 1.3 billion people, calls for repealing the law have grown louder in all northeastern states. But will the BJP government in New Delhi move to abolish it? No one is quite ready to bet on that.
Now, to have more insight, we are joined by Mr. Kalol Bhattacharjee, Senior Assistant Editor with the Hindu newspaper. Now, welcome to the program, Mr. Bhattacharjee. Let's begin with the recent civilian killings in northeast India's Nagaland state, which have reignited the long-running debate about the use and abuse of the Armed Forces Special Powers Act. Now, can you tell us what exactly happened in Nagaland?
Hello, thank you so much for inviting me to this bulletin and this discussion on the developments regarding AFSPA or AFSPA, as we call it in India. What happened that evening in Nagaland is that a group of daily wage workers were returning home from their work in a nearby mine. And while they were returning, they were ambushed by a group of Indian soldiers, who also were reportedly working on solid intelligence inputs that a group of insurgents were waiting to carry out an attack on the Indian soldiers. And so the report that came later on to us is that these soldiers were targeted by these, were to be targeted by these reported insurgents, and therefore this ambush was carried out in a defensive way, so that insurgents could be neutralized. However, later on we heard that the issue was of mistaken identity, as it was claimed by the Indian Home Minister in the Parliament, and that the soldiers felt that they were going to be ambushed by a group of insurgents, and therefore they acted in self-defense. But very soon we got to know that the local villagers were the first to arrive at the scene, and they discovered that the bodies of those people who had been shot dead were being loaded onto a jeep or some other vehicles that the army soldiers were driving around in. So the local villagers came, and then they attacked the Indian soldiers, and which really led to a massive mayhem at that point. And that was the main reason that an Indian soldier also lost his life. It was, in brief, the entire sequence of events.
So, Mr. Bhattacharjee, this much-abused law grants the Indian Army unbridled powers to maintain public order in so-called disturbed areas. Now, do you think this is a smokescreen to escape accountability for human rights abuses?
I would also like to mention that this particular area of Nagaland is very close to the international border with Myanmar. And also, please remember that the crisis in Myanmar has been escalating over the last 8 months or so. And the international community has not really acted in a collective manner to ensure any sort of pressure on the Myanmarese junta. What's happening as a result is that there is a spillover effect on the nearby areas, especially on India's northeastern areas. where a lot of the smuggling activities have heightened, because the Myanmar rulers themselves are involved in drugs and other sorts of smuggling activities. And what's of great concern is that apart from the exodus of people from Myanmar, there is also this influx of these goods and items and drugs into India's border areas and also into Bangladesh. So this has also heightened tension among the heightened tension as well as distrust among the armed forces or the law enforcement agencies, as well as the locals and those people who are involved in those sort of activities, illicit activities. So this basically, in the context of this particular development in India's neighboring Myanmar, what's happening is that this kind of a law, that is a law like AFSPA, has more chances of getting abused, because if there is faulty information or intelligence about a certain movement of drugs or movement of insurgents, then these sort of laws actually increase the chances of such incidents being repeated in future as well.
Like you've mentioned, there have been numerous protests in northeastern Indian states as well as in Jammu and Kashmir against this law over the years. Now, how do Indian authorities justify its continued use?
Well, as you understand, the situation in Kashmir has been problematic for a very long time because of India's position as well as because of Pakistan's perceived interference. What happens in Kashmir is that the law and order situation on the ground is always very fragile because of cross-border attempts from the Pakistani side to keep the pot boiling in Kashmir, and on the ground level you have lot of presence, with a big presence of the ultras or the other, insurgents from the other side are always present in some numbers. So that is one issue which the Indian state has often cited as one of the main reasons why it has kept AFSPA in Kashmir. And that is often the only answer that we have received from the Indian state or whenever the extra-legal developments have taken place in Kashmir. Having said that, I must say that that is not the only legal instrument in the hands of the Indian state as far as Kashmir is concerned, because the region is highly militarized. And in that context, not a very normal governance process can't really function. And therefore, the Kashmiri situation is very unique. And the Indian state is often cited that as one of the main reasons that has enabled its use of AFSPA on the ground in Kashmir.
Before we let you go, sir, one last question. Why has there been no international outcry over the Indian government's use of the controversial law?
Well, there has not been any international outcry on the AFSPA, primarily because India prides itself on its democratic credentials. But also please remember that after this particular incident took place in Nagaland, whether we call it an outcry or not, the issue of AFSPA or the abuse of such extra-legal matters laws by the enforcement agencies or the Indian Armed Forces has been taken up by the UN Human Rights Council.
Mr. Bhattacharjee, thank you for your precious time and knowledge. Now, let's see how people on social media see the situation.
Senior Indian journalist Supriya Sharma says the families of civilians killed by the Indian Army in Nagaland have refused government compensation until the culprits are punished and the controversial law is repealed. Conrad Sangma, the Chief Minister of Northeastern Indian State of Meghalaya, extends his support to protesters in Nagaland in their demand to have AFSPA repealed from the Northeast. A legislator from northwestern Gujarat state, Jignesh Mavani, says the Nagaland killings should force authorities to rethink and review the draconian law so that accountability can be fixed.
You're listening to the subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to the subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
The centuries-old central mosque in the summer capital of Indian-controlled Kashmir has remained largely locked for the past 2 years since the abrogation of the region's special status sparked unrest. Built in the 15th century, the mosque is seen by Indian authorities as a trouble spot. It's a place where Kashmiri Muslims gather to offer Friday prayers and to raise voice for their legitimate political aspirations. They see its closure as denial of their right to religious freedom.
The closure of the Himalayan region's 600-year-old central mosque known as Jamia Masjid and denial of permission to Kashmiri Muslims to hold the congressional Friday prayers for the past 2 years has deepened anger and resentment among them. The mosque was shut down immediately after the Narendra Modi-led BJP government in New Delhi stripped Indian-controlled Kashmir of its semi-autonomous status. In the past 2 years, which have been marked by intermittent protests and shutdowns, the historic mosque has remained out of bounds to worshippers on Fridays, even though authorities allow it to remain open on other days. Jamia Masjid has played a key role in the region's turbulent history. It has traditionally been the bastion of resistance against Kashmir's autocratic rulers. In 1819, Sikh rulers had closed it for 21 years. During the rule of Dogra Hindu dynasty between 1846 and 1947, the mosque often remained shut. In the past 30 years, since the anti-India resistance gained momentum in Kashmir, Jamia Masjid has been subject to periodic bans and lockdowns by successive Indian governments. The chief priest of the mosque and senior pro-freedom leader, Mirwaz Umar Farooq, has often delivered fiery political speeches from the mosque's pulpit, highlighting the political struggle of Kashmiris. Interestingly, in the year 1980, during his visit to Kashmir, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Sayyid Ali Khamenei, had also delivered a historic sermon at the mosque, which focused on Shia-Sunni unity.
While the Indian government, as part of sweeping measures to crush political dissent, has imposed a tougher security clampdown in Indian-controlled Kashmir since October 2019, infringement of religious freedom has been a long-lasting phenomenon in the disputed region. Besides closing mosques and putting religious leaders and clerics under house arrest, there is a long-running ban on the historic Muharram temple session in Srinagar city, which Kashmiri Muslims see as a blatant breach of their religious freedom.
Muharram processions in Kashmir date back to the early 16th century, when both Shia and Sunni Muslims would come together to parade the streets on the day of Ashura. The processions were banned during the rule of Afghans, followed by Mughals, Sikhs, and Dogras, who had a hostile attitude toward Shias. However, in the latter part of the Dogra rule in the late 19th century, the tradition was revived with the cooperation of both the communities. In 1989, when armed resistance against the Indian rule began in Kashmir, the government of India moved swiftly to impose a ban on the procession as part of sweeping measures to deal with the political unrest. Almost 33 years later, the ban remains in place. Each year, police impose curfew-like restrictions on Muharram 8th and 10th in the heart of Srinagar city to foil the Muharram processions. And each year, thousands of mourners defy the ban and carry out peaceful processions while being subjected to brutal police action. Mourners are intercepted by heavily armed police and paramilitary personnel who fire tear smoke canisters and resort to baton charge. Last year, dozens of them were arrested who spent months in jail. Despite repeated pleas, the successive Indian governments have refused to lift the illegal ban.
Now, to have more insight, I would like to welcome Mr. Zamir Ahmad Awan to the program. He is an ex-diplomat and political analyst. Mr. Awan, the centuries-old Grand Mosque of Kashmir has remained closed for the past 2 years. Why is the historic mosque seen as a trouble spot by Indian authorities?
Thank you very much for inviting me to give my comments. In fact, it is a symbolic mosque. It belongs to the Islamic history and represent the Muslim community in the Kashmir. Historically, India was ruled by the Muslim for almost 800 years, and there was a complete harmony between the Muslims and the other religions in India under the Islamic rule. Since the India got independence in 1947, for almost seven decades, Muslims and other minorities in India were living almost peacefully. But since the BJP government took power under the leadership of Narendra Modi, the extremist wings like RSS are promoting hate against the minorities, especially against the Muslims. And they have an agenda to purify the India as a pure Indian state without any other religion. So they are also harming other religion in addition to the Muslims, like Christian, Sikhs, and Buddhists, and all other religion. Especially in the Kashmir, where the Muslims are in the majority, they are more harming the Muslims. And this mosque has historical importance. That's why they have closed for the almost couple of years.
Mr. Awan, the Hindu nationalist government in New Delhi has taken many controversial measures since October 2019. Now, do you see the closure of the mosque as part of a plan to deny Kashmiris their religious freedom?
You are absolutely right. Since 2019, Narendra Modi, when won the election, his slogan was to convert the India into a pure Hindu state. And he has got the support from all the extremist Hindu groups like RSS. And as per his agenda, as per his promise in the election, he have to take severe and extremist measures against the minorities, not only against the Muslim, but also against the Christian and other religions also, like amended Citizen Act, canceling the constitution and occupying the occupied Kashmir, and also many other measures which are extremist, and that is the part of their political plan, and they might do something more harmful to the Muslims.
So for Muslims in Kashmir, the mosque closure also brings painful memories from the past. Why has this mosque always been at the center of political storm?
Always the center point for the political activities in Kashmir. The Muslim freedom movement in Kashmir is always having meetings there and gathering there, and a lot of protest against the Indian government was originated from this mosque. And in past also the Indian security forces has sealed it and closed it for many times, but recently they have taken various prolonged action to close down this mosque. I think it is political motivated and ill planned.
Mr. Awan, the Indian government has also not allowed the historic Muharram procession to take place in the Srinagar city for the past 3 decades. Now, why is it afraid of peaceful religious practices of Kashmiri Muslims?
In fact, the Indian government is suppressing the Muslims and not allowing them to perform their religious duties. The procession of Muharram is a ritual and has been performing for many centuries peacefully, but Indian government is afraid when the Muslims are gathered, they might protest against the government, or they might make some slogans against the government. So in preventing such a situation, they have not allowed the Muharram procession for several years. In fact, not only the Muharram procession, but also other religious activities also are banned.
Mr. Awan, while Muslims are barred from exercising their right to religious freedom, Hindus are allowed to perform their religious rites, even publicly. Now, do these double standards point to something deeply sinister?
In India, there are many other religions and minorities. The dominating is the Brahmin, which are only 8% of the whole population. but they are in power, they are in the government, they are in the bureaucracy, they are in the security forces, they are in the police, they are in the district management, and they are controlling all these things, and they are suppressing the Muslims, especially in the Kashmir, where Muslims are in the majority.
Mr. Awan, thank you for being on the program. Love to talk to you again. Now.